Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Kate Wheeler. Her first book of stories was called Not Where I Started From. It's available in a Mariner edition from Houghton Mifflin. And she was chosen one of the Grant Young American Novelists Most Bearing Watching. Now her first novel, When Mountains Walked, has been published by Houghton Mifflin. And I wanted to begin, I think, a good way to get into a conversation about this book and how it feels to read would be to mention that it has, in the course of its author's closing note, one of the most peculiar things I think I've seen ever. There's the sentence, what may seem melodramatic in this book is intended to be so. And it sounds like the sentence appears as a result of some kind of arm wrestle. Can you say?
Well, I think I was thinking very fictionally when I wrote this, and I also wanted not to be sort of seen as the author. And, you know, like, I don't like people to try to get at me through the book somehow. And that had happened quite a bit. A lot of people who met me after reading my short stories said, how many of these things did you really do? And I wanted them to just read the book and read the book as a book. So I felt kind of troubled by that aspect of it. Also, there more happens in this book than usually happens to people, you know. There's the plot of a Hindi movie secreted in there, which I don't think of as being a very realistic way of portraying human nature. But I wanted there to be, you know, sort of dramatic things and mysterious things and things that would make people keep reading, wanting to know what happened next. But I didn't want anyone to think that I thought of these things as being sort of exactly the way I think about naturalistic human nature, sort of. So I think that's what I was trying to say, that it's some of the things that happen are a little elevated, and that I meant that.
It's set between two generations, that of a grandmother and a granddaughter. Both of them have spent time in South America, although the grandmother finds her passion in India, the granddaughter hers in Peru. And at a certain point, both of these women, for all of the romantic bravado of their mates, find something else more attractive than the man they've originally chosen. How did that come to be the shape of the book?
The doubling aspect of it. Actually, that has a real psychological resonance for me because one of my grandmothers actually disappeared, and I never knew who she was, and I knew about her from rumors in our family. And there was a way in which I tried to find her in myself, like from things that were said about her. I guess she was a kind of a scandalous person, and so often I would find myself saying things like, well, I wonder if she would have done what I just did, kind of thing. And in beginning to write this book, I sort of mushed my two grandmothers together, and because both of them had a similar life, and they had a life that I had, which is to live overseas. They had a life that my mother had, which was to live overseas following the career of a man who has something sort of to do. And it was a thing that kind of puzzled me as to how they sort of lived. To me, back in the 1930s, for a woman actually to go and live, my father's mother went to live in the Colombian rainforest, and she kind of wasn't supposed to. My grandfather was working for Standard Oil, exploring for oil at the time, and my grandmother went down a little bit on her own account to live there with him. And I pondered a little bit about this, and I started writing the grandmother chapters, which, as you know, are sort of inset between the other ones, as a novel of its own, to sort of try to figure out how someone thinks of themselves. And of course it has some relevance to my own life, or how I think of relationships, or how I think of myself, or how is a self defined. And In my own life, we moved every year, which is something I put into my stories pretty clearly. And maybe that made me more fragmented or something, but to sort of, you know, what's the essential being of a person? It's also a, you know, it's a cultural question nowadays, like how essential is culture? How essential is the family that you were born into and the culture that, the heritage, your genetics, all those things. So all those things kind of.
Now, the feeling that there are two kinds of men in each of these women's life, the man that they first think that they love and have every reason, in a sense, to love. They don't forget why they love that man.
Right.
But they find something else, and that other man seems to play the role that Buddhism plays in your first book of stories.
Oh, how so?
Well, it's a different way of life and thinking about life,
yeah,
and a different way of ordering life, and a different set of priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed to me that these women are all being given a set of choices that they don't at first see themselves as having.
Right. I think that's true, and the choice that they make continues to be to try to experience that through a man. And the conclusion of the book, I think, is for Maggie, the narrator, to find sort of in herself that thing, or that, you know, that non-objective quality of sort of being viable without having to import qualities from the outside.
Now, one of the things that I noticed as I was reading When Mountains Walked by my guest Kate Wheeler is that the book takes us to so many places we haven't been. It begins on a bus ride into the deepest canyon in the world, deeper than the Grand Canyon, and it takes us to India. That there's a lot of young writers are showing us what the writing can do, or what research plus writing can do, but you hardly get a chance to think here about the writing, or at least I didn't as a reader, because I was going to so many unusual places, and it seemed as if experience was the teacher here, not writing workshops.
Oh, well, thank you for saying so. I spent quite a lot of time in South America during the writing of this book, and I have been to nearly every one of the places that that I describe in there, except for Mongolia. But but I had read about a Mongolian earthquake, the one which the Johnny visits in the book, and I was impressed, maybe sort of in the same sense as the mystery of a person who's never been met. That's very important in your life, a very important shadow influence about whom lies are told and secrets are kept. But that once there was a Mongolian earthquake. I think it was in the 1930s, although I messed around with the date so much I can't remember when it was anymore, that almost no one saw it because it was in a nomadic area, but it was the kind of earthquake, the strongest kind of earthquake that can ever be produced. And weeks later, when the scientific teams arrived, the mountains were still collapsing. So the mountains continued to fall down for weeks and weeks and weeks. And the idea of this cataclysmic event that happened without witnesses, also for some reason I found very intriguing, and I could have almost called that the germ of the book in some other way, you know, the sort of Moby Dick aspect of it or something.
Yeah, it's a sort of Joseph Conrad kind of novel, and it's the kind of novel that Robert Stone loves, and indeed there is a quote from him on its back, on the back cover, where different ways of living in the world are presented as different kinds of adventures, and then these adventures are compared with one another both passionately but also morally.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's a question about what is a serious life, and then implicitly here, can a woman lead a serious life until she can separate herself from the destiny, for lack of a better word, that she's been attached to. And the man at the end of the book, in fact, says that he cannot go with the woman because it's not his destiny. And implicitly, there's a question, can a woman say that? I will not be at your side. I have imagined a different destiny.
Well, I hope that at the end of the book that I convey that Maggie, my heroine, has done that. Although she's a very qualified heroine, I do mean her to really send the two men off with one another into their destiny, and for her, thus, you know, for herself, claim her own destiny, which is not entirely reduced to the fact that she's pregnant and carrying a child that she has to protect. I mean, I think it does give her some sense of the moral weight of her decisions, but it's not sort of the only thing that she's thinking of when she realizes that she can sort of do without them and she can leave this forest alone. And the book ends with her in the middle of the forest, imagining her way out of the forest, but she is by herself and she, you know, she knows that she can get out, or she thinks she knows she can get out. I leave it up to the reader, I guess, to decide whether they feel that she's reached this resolution or not.
Now, this is your first novel, and did you know that you could write one? And what was your experience in the course of it as you went along? Did you feel it's very confidently written, I have to say.
Oh, well, that may have been helped by Grantas having declared me a novelist before long before I'd finished, which I think I published an excerpt, or they published an excerpt of this, about 4 years before I was finished with writing it. The chapter where Althea dies now is in chapters 20-ish, and it was going to be the beginning of the book. But I realized, in sort of the fictional nuts and bolts side of things, if you kill off a beloved character in the first chapter, then the whole rest of the book has to be about them. And I mean, actually, it has been through so many different shapes and forms, with so many reams thrown away. It was in the first person. You know, I was the grandmother in India in 1930, and then I changed that. I got tired of too much research. You know, was there toothpaste? things like that. to be, you know, short, I didn't know how to write a novel, and I felt that I was as if I were just walking deeper and deeper into a swamp whose bottom might or might not level out. And would the water close over my head or not? I was never really sure.
Well, I don't even know how to find out if there was toothpaste. How do you do that, in fact?
I guess that was something I didn't want to overdo the research side. I didn't want to get lost in it. I read a number of geological books. That was fun. And I have 2 years of undergraduate geology education. But I think you have to kind of ask around. And I have people I could call on the phone to find out. Or, you know, I could have gone also back to Calcutta and asked someone, you know. But, you know, then I would have forgotten enough of, you know, there would have been another question coming up. And actually, there are a few things here I decided that I didn't care about. Like, I don't know if there would have been microphones in the walls in the Soviet Union in 1930. Maybe not. But I got to that, and I was writing it, and I thought, I don't care. So I just put it in.
Now, what we're hearing is that this is a fairly unusual kind of novel. This is an epic romance in a certain sense, in addition to being a novel of revolution and a novel of passion and a novel, to some extent, of ideas about activism. And in that way, it's not the kind of novel that many young writers are writing right now. I wondered how you came to take it on.
I wanted to justify readers' interest in reading it. Like, I wanted to actually deliver something. I wanted people to keep reading, like, terrified of letting people drop away after page 2 or 1 or something like that. So I felt like I had to make it eventful in a certain way, and I wanted to have an outcome. Like, I think in a way the idea that women have to choose through men is something that I've lived through myself, and I think a lot of women have lived through men being a passport somehow, or the sort of the way of incorporating someone else's traits through love, or, you know, thinking that you will become someone that you aren't. And some of that does seem to work, but it doesn't work in the way it seems to work. It seems to you in the beginning that it might, but that so for Maggie to sort of find herself, I kind of felt like I had to get to that. And I wasn't sure how I was going to do that either. It was actually a conversation in a taxi cab in La Paz, I remember very well, on the main street, where a friend of mine was saying something. And I thought, oh, thank God. You know, that's going to be what she comes to in the end. And I was, at the time, kind of writing the final scene. And,
yes, you say, you know, in many acknowledgments that so-and-so gave you that ending.
Or, right.
I mean, fiction is influenced by what, the coincidences of conversation or by the friends that the stories are modeled on? What is the process?
Or the remarks or the impressions. And I think maybe what you were saying about the experiential quality is maybe the way I live, perhaps, and maybe why if Maggie is an alter ego, it's confusing to be someone who lives a lot in the present moment of impressions. But say if I would go for a walk and a little bird would fly up, and it would strike me, you know, in some way, almost visionary way, I'd go put it in the book. You know,
well, how do you live and where have you lived? Just so that listeners know what your origins are.
Well, I also want to say that people meddled in my book. Like, my father told me to change things, and my editor told me I wasn't allowed to put Maggie in prison at the end, and all of these things happen. And I take my book to a group, so it's all been, there's a collaborative aspect to it in my life. And I was very nearly born in South America. I was born instead in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My parents were working there my father was working for Exxon. And I went to Venezuela with my mother when I was about a month old and moved around South America until eighth grade, came to the United States to spend junior high, and I blamed all of my hormonal imbalances on U.S. culture, I think, and went back to Argentina, finished high school there, stayed a year. My mother, who had a view of life and women that may be expressed here, told me that I should go to secretarial school in case my husband ever left me before I went to college, just to make sure I had something to fall back on. So I stayed in Argentina and learned shorthand and things like that.
Argentinian shorthand?
Yeah. Well, no, it was an Australian method taught by a British lady. And then I came to Rice University thinking I could escape to Mexico. Really, that was a real thing. Then I went to Miami, got a job in the bilingual newspaper, Miami Herald, thinking often about the presence of Hispanic people. And since I spoke Spanish as early as English, and then went to Stanford, and then... I don't know. That's a little too blow-by-blow. But I traveled quite a bit in Asia and during my Buddhist practice, ordained briefly as a nun in Rangoon, disrobed. I'm not a nun now. I continue to visit Asia. I was in India earlier this year.
Now, people seem... Because, you know, way before, not when I started from the Book of Stories by my guest Kate Wheeler came out, people were already anticipating that, and then the novel became the very long-anticipated novel. So how does a writer become known in that way before there's a book?
I don't know. I won a lot of prizes, and I've always, you know, there's an angel hanging over that aspect so far of my work, because there's a slightly... darling quality to how well some of my work's been received, at least aesthetically, you know, not financially really yet, but I've gotten a lot of attention for my relatively, you know, I wouldn't say they're meager, it's just that I write very painstakingly, so it takes me a long time to finish anything. That's why they're long awaited. But when I went to Stanford the first quarter I was there, I wrote a story that eventually ended up in the O. Henry Awards, and not where I started from. I thought I had 10 more years of work before a collection was ready, but in the same year I won an O. Henry and was nominated for Best, or I included in Best American Short Stories. And when they came after me and were ready to offer me money and money that where I could just sort of go off and revise and revise and revise, then I finished the book in 9 months. And I revised stories that I had been lying around in despair over a lot faster, and it became that book much sooner than I thought.
Now, how does the traveling fit in terms of writing, getting writing done?
Being away from the United States for me is an ideal way to write. If I can set up a base somewhere where there's the phone barely rings, where there's a simplicity in the way that I am able to be in a place, it's sort of there's a quietness and a lack of sort of trivial driving around in the car sort of stuff that really helps me. I'm very easy to be distracted by things. So that during the writing of this book, I spent 9 months living in Bolivia, and it was great because a lot of the impressions that would have been otherwise distractions here, I just went back and put them in the book again. And that sense of being alive in my experience, I think I feel more overseas, and I feel at home outside the United States in a certain way, maybe because I've puzzled over that and then just decided to leave it. Either did I grow up that way? Is that why? Or is it a vice of some sort that I have? But something.
Well, Maggie and her husband, Carson, at the beginning of this book, have gone to reopen a clinic in Peru at the bottom of said deepest canyon in the world. It's been closed for some time. It has, its locks need to be snapped, and it's filthy inside. In fact, filth seems to be one of the ongoing themes and concerns. People need to be educated about filth. The husband starts painting a series of cartoons outside the clinic, which no one will enter because they're convinced that these gringos will sterilize men and eat the fat of children. And so the building becomes a kind of mural place for cartoons about health care. But there's no end to the physical discomfort that this book presents its characters. And I wondered, are environments like that particularly appealing to you as a beginning place for the imagination?
Well, those murals, although I said that I don't like to admit that things are real because they're only objects in a fiction, exist in rural Peru, and they're quite effective in portraying, you know, the things that you shouldn't do, you know, or you should do.
Or not step on.
Right, exactly. You know, about flies and things like that. And I'm not sure why I think, you know, maybe it's just that the romantic sublime is available in places where it is uncomfortable sometimes. You know, I'm not sure that I'm drawn to the discomfort, but maybe, you know, to the grandeur of those places also. You know, like, I mean, even I went to mountaineering school after college, and it took me a while to integrate the fact that it was really quite uncomfortable. I thought it was just going to be glory and gorgeousness and nature and everything, and I hadn't realized that, you know, my pack was going to be heavy and, you know, it was going to be cold at night and things like that. But eventually I decided that it was sort of worth it. But it is interesting in terms of the texture of one's experience when you're there, because it is like that. You're afraid a lot of the time. You're dirtier than usual. You know, come back to the United States after India and really clean your fingernails and really clean your feet, things like that.
Well, there's a part, the point that Maggie comes to, when a blister reopens and she's bleeding toward the end of the novel, and she feels kind of happy about it because she thinks the earth goddess likes blood. Yeah. And there's a certain point at which the romantic sense of what travel, helpfulness, Peace Corps-like behavior, that gives way to a deeper nature red in tooth and claw attitude, that the world is not necessarily our friend, doesn't benefit from our attempts to do good deeds in it, and it may want to eat us up.
There are another point before she goes on that sort of apocalyptic flight into the jungle. She imagines that it would be all right if the earth ate her. And maybe that's a little bit of a resonance with the Buddhist point of view of being a little bit less armored and protected against things, you know, and the distinction between pleasant and unpleasant. If that is less of a point of strong reaction for and against for you, that there's another kind of state of being integrated that you can reach. It's interesting that you bring that up. I never thought of it.
I was interested in that, actually, because it seemed to me here that since you're dealing with India and South America, the absence of a specific Buddhist point of view seemed very noticeable, since it is so present in the stories. But I'm interested, does Buddhist practice help you in that kind of, what would you say, forced march that a novel, I think especially a first novel, really is, where what you're having to provide is endurance, and an endurance that you don't know you have?
Right. Frank Conroy wrote in a book I took up for him to sign, Persevere, and that was very interesting advice. I think that actually the strength of mind from my novel will help my Buddhist practice also, because Buddhist practice has a format and a language to describe some of the process of meditation. Meditation is a very well-described process, and although I don't like to talk very much about the process of writing per se in those ways, I feel like, you know, the mental strength to go back to it, to be, you know, fail, to see the things that you write every many days just, you read them the next day and you go, ugh, you know, this is really in bad taste. Well, how could I think that? How could I say that? You know, and face yourself on those levels, and then be willing to revise things that you love, you know, that aren't working, and all those things. I think, you know, I guess I don't believe in lofty things, but that Buddhist practice does, you know, as a person, afford me access to some transcendent dimension that I don't get to otherwise. And the book also, in the levels of concentration that I felt or things like that, it has some parallels, but maybe I don't want to make too much of an you know, exact correspondence between them.
But it does bring me back to the initial question that that author's note that we were talking about earlier, that the things in this book that seem melodramatic were meant to. Because my sense is that the Buddhist way is to still the impulse toward melodrama. And if writing, the thing that you talk about that keeps people going after page two, depends upon melodrama,
right.
I'm very interested in the contrast there.
Right, well, it's a contrast, and you're right. I mean, the first book I wrote or edited when I came back from being a nun in Burma was a book of discourses by the abbot of the monastery where I'd lived. And I sort of was letting the beast out a little bit, I guess. And then I felt like it was writing can be a very transgressive act anyway. I know reading once, browsing through a book, I found that the angel of literature went with Lucifer down. You know, he didn't want to stay in heaven where it was boring and there's the unruptured
piece. Is that true?
I think so. I don't know what, you know, I wish I had the source still, or remembered his Latin name. Maybe someone who's listening will know about this. But I think that that's true, and that, you know, that you have to, you know, blotch the page somehow and be willing to do that. And I don't, you know, maybe I wish I didn't have to, but I have to. I just have to. That's all. I didn't want to stay in Burma for 10 years, and I knew I had to come back to the United States and probably write about it. And even if then, you know, I was also diligently doing the meditation at the same time as thoroughly as I could possibly do it. And I think it's all right, you know, like I guess I sort of think that even if life is horrible, it's okay, you know, and so whatever I do is okay. Not whatever, but you know what I mean. It's all right to do this. If there really is such a thing as some sort of totality, how could you ever rupture it by writing about it anyway?
I've been speaking to Kate Wheeler, the author most recently of the novel When Mountains Walked from Houghton Mifflin, the author as well of Not Where I Started From, a book of short stories. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with a book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.